loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Jeff Sessions was forced to resign by Donald Trump as the U.S. Attorney General. Sessions has been condemned by people on the left for his history of bigotry, racism, and super hardline, no-tolerance policy, so-called, at the U.S.-Mexican border. But now the Democrats are denouncing the firing of Jeff Sessions. We're going to look at why. And we're also going to talk about Jeff Sessions' replacement and what it means for the Mueller probe going forward. And then we continue our weekly series, it's every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, 12 people were killed in a horrendous mass shooting at a bar in Southern California last night. Details are still emerging, but we have learned that the shooter was a 28-year-old combat veteran of the Marine Corps in Afghanistan. Next, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg fell and broke three ribs late last night. With conservative justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch in their 50s and Samuel Alito and John Roberts in their 60s, what could the court look like if Trump makes more appointments? Then, dangerous new anti-abortion ballot measures passed in Alabama and West Virginia this week, setting up for an intense and protracted court battle. Is the historic Roe v. Wade decision in jeopardy? And then, intense fighting took place last night in the province of Tikar in Afghanistan, killing 14 Afghan government soldiers. As the government loses ground, is there any hope for a negotiated peace? And finally, we continue with the second half of this week's regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. And in other headlines, Georgia Republican gubernatorial candidate Brian Kemp has resigned as Georgia's Secretary of State after claiming victory in the governor's race. But votes are still being counted, and Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams has not conceded. Today was supposed to be the date for another set of talks between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and high-ranking North Korean officials, but they were canceled. This meeting was supposed to outline the second summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The U.S. State Department has said that, quote, ongoing conversations continue to take place, unquote, regarding the peace process. Yemeni residents and health workers are reporting continued and increased levels of violence around the port city of Hodeida, where life-saving humanitarian aid comes in. The violence is also edging closer to medical facilities. The Saudi coalition has continued airstrikes, and U.S.-made helicopters are targeting residential neighborhoods in and around the city. 58 combatants died today, at least. 27 people have been killed in a major prison riot in Tajikistan. The riot began when an alleged ISIS member who was being held in the prison seized a guard's rifle. 25 of the dead are inmates and 2 are guards. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the forced resignation, the firing of Jeff Sessions. He's out as Attorney General after a long period of conflict and tension with Donald Trump. We'll review the ultra-right-wing policies that earned him the ire of so many millions of people across the country, and we'll consider what his replacement by acting Attorney General Whitaker might mean for the future of the Mueller investigation. We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and a partner at the law firm Goodman, Hurwitz & James. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. Dan is the author of several books, including The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Julie and Dan, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to say, I think I live in an Alice in Wonderland world. Everything seems upside down because I was listening to progressive radio stations. I won't mention them by name right now, but they seem to be suddenly in love with Jeff Sessions because Donald Trump fired him. Jeff Sessions, Julie Hurwitz, how could progressive people think fondly of Jeff Sessions? I mean, I thought we wanted him fired all the time because he was such a racist, such a bigot, such a xenophobe, tearing children away from their moms and dads at the border. Anyway, you know a lot about Jeff Sessions. Let's help the audience understand some of that record.
Well, we certainly are living in a topsy-turvy reality, I have to say. It's not only Jeff Sessions, but it's Mueller himself. It's Comey. It's, you know, everybody who we have known for years is an enemy of everything that's good and progressive and forward-thinking, and they are now our big heroes. And the legacy of Jeff Sessions goes back for decades. While he was on the U.S. Senate, he was in the forefront of a number of very right-wing agendas, covering a number of issues from criminal justice to privatizing prisons to legitimizing police misconduct and abandoning any oversight over runaway police departments around the country, the war on drug. He was in the forefront of doing everything he can to continue to criminalize things like marijuana, immigrant rights, as you mentioned, actively opposing extending hate crime protections to women, the LGBTQ community, and other and racial issues. He has vigorously defended the travel bans. He has actively worked over the years, going back to the 1980s, to gut the Voting Rights Act. In the 1980s, he actually prosecuted black civil rights activists for helping to get out the vote in Alabama. He was in the forefront of the repeal of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. He is just a horrible human being. And the fact that he did one thing that we might consider to be somewhat ethical by recusing himself from the Mueller investigation, now all of a sudden he's everybody's hero. I think one reason, though, that people are legitimately concerned about this forced resignation is that this guy Whitaker is probably 10 times worse than Sessions and is willing to do Trump's bidding even on questions of putting the kibosh on the Mueller investigation, which Sessions at least was not willing to do.
Let's get Dan Kovalik. Dan, your take on that.
Yeah, well, again, Sessions is an unreconstructed Southern racist, and that was reflected in how he carried out his job as head of the Justice Department. In particular, you know, the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, he has really cut back on at a time when we see massive disenfranchisement of voters, intimidation of voters. And so, yeah, I can't be sad to see him go. But as Julie points out, we may be seeing something worse. As you know, I've never taken a lot of stock in the Mueller investigation because I've never believed much in the Russiagate hysteria. So, in fact, have seen that as a negative, as something that is just ginning up support for the military, support for war, and unnecessary animosity towards Russia. So I can't say that I'm that sad to see that possibly go away. But what I am worried about is the enforcement of our civil rights laws.
Yeah, both Jeff Sessions and his replacement, Whitaker, who's a far-right political, Matthew Whitaker, political hack, actually, political operative. None of them care about civil rights. Well, they care about it in the sense that they're trying to undo civil rights and social rights that have been won by social justice movements and by people sacrificing so much over so many decades to win basic rights, the expansion of democracy. All of that is under a vigorous assault. It seems to me, I want to throw my two cents in and then get both of you to react. Maybe first back to you, Dan, because I know you have a limited time to join us today. It seems to me that the Mueller investigation, in fact, has nothing really significant to offer regarding Russian collusion. It's been going on now for, you know, it's been going on for a long time. The FBI started the investigation in June or July 2016. Now we're at the end of 2018, almost 2019. The Mueller probe had a number of indictments and some convictions, but they're over lying and money laundering and et cetera, et cetera. Not about actual collusion. Even Michael Flynn's lie regarding to the FBI 4 days after he became National Security Advisor was about his call to the Russian ambassador trying to get him to do what Israel wanted to do, which was to have Russia postpone or not vote yes on a resolution at the UN condemning Israeli settlements that the Obama administration said it would abstain on. It seemed to me that there's nothing there. And what Trump might be worried about now, though, is that the Russia, the Mueller probe, unable to really come up with anything about Russia collusion, will move on either to Donald Trump's taxes, which might show that Donald Trump, in fact, is not a huge billionaire and a huge success, not to mention maybe carrying out illegal acts regarding taxes. And Mueller may be thinking about indicting Donald Trump Jr. over whether he lied to the FBI when he, as some are saying, failed to tell the FBI that he had told his father, Donald Trump, about that infamous meeting at Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer who Rob Goldstone, the music promoter, had said had dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russian government, something which turned out not to be true. In which case, Donald Trump doesn't want and has made it clear, Dan Kovalik, has made it clear that if Mueller goes after his personal finances, this is going to be war. Or certainly if he tries to indict Donald Trump Jr., again, absent actual evidence of collusion, that too would be a war. I think those might be the issues right now. What do you think?
Yes, well, I agree with that. And I guess I have, in all honesty, mixed feelings about it. I am happy for Trump's taxes to be looked into. I hope they are. I hope his business dealings are looked into. I certainly believe that he was a dirty businessman. And so I have no problem with that being looked into. On the other hand, what's bothered me from the get-go is that Mueller and those who support Mueller have been less than honest about the fact that the Russiagate investigation as such has borne no fruit. And instead, every indictment, whether it has to do with Russia at all, and virtually none have anything to do with that, is seen as some sort of vindication for the whole vilification of Russia. And that's what really bothers me. The other thing that I think is a little troubling is that, you know, Mueller's mandate was to investigate alleged Russian collusion. And to the extent that he goes way beyond that, I do think people, as a matter of principle, should be concerned whether that comports with our notions of democracy and due process.
Julie Hurwitz, all three of us, I know, are fervent opponents of Donald Trump's policies. But it seems to me that the issue of whether the Mueller probe is just an open-ended fishing expedition against about all things related to Donald Trump so that ultimately they can find something, it does seem to go beyond what the public thought the probe was about, which was to prove, if there was proof, that Russia colluded and somehow made Donald Trump our president. Anyway, what's your view?
Well, I have probably a slightly different take on the investigation and what is being accomplished as a result of the investigation or through the course of this investigation. I'm perfectly comfortable with them uncovering whatever they can to expose the dishonest and ulterior activities of all of these folks who, from Donald Trump all the way around, you know, and everybody around him and affiliated with him. So I'm not as troubled by this ongoing investigation, I guess, as you guys are. Also, I acknowledge you probably know more of the ins and outs of what's going on as part of this investigation than I do, but the lies that are clearly being told all do. I mean, in a way, there is a causal link between everybody who's been caught lying and has subsequently been indicted. I don't think it's completely disconnected from the primary mandate that started this investigation to begin with. You know, the lies that are being told, the cover-ups that are occurring, the financial finagling that is going on in all likelihood, I think can easily all be tied to whatever this relationship is. Well, maybe not so easily, but can be tied to this bizarre relationship between Trump and Putin and the Russian government and its role in doing whatever it could to, force a defeat of Hillary in 2016. So, I think the investigation should be left alone. I think that it should continue.
Let's go back to Dan, because he's not going to be with us that much longer. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, what strikes me, you know, everyone talks about this relationship between Trump and Putin, and obviously there is some kind of relationship. But meanwhile, Trump just backed out of a major nuclear proliferation agreement with Russia. I mean, I don't think that was at the behest of Vladimir Putin. In fact, it seems to go quite against what Putin would have wanted.
Well, no one's ever accused Donald Trump of being consistent. I mean, really, to me, it's sort of par for the course. Yeah, on one hand, he's got this love relationship with the guy, and on the other hand, he sees something.
Yeah, but I'm afraid that Russiagate may have egged him on into, you know, leading us closer to nuclear war, and that's where I think the whole Russiagate thing has been detrimental.
Julie, let me just make this point. We have the National Security Strategy, which is now telling the American people, get ready for major power conflict with Russia or China. That's happening. Like, the Pentagon is reorienting, and we're targeting China, Russia. Now we're targeting China, too. At the same time, as the Russiagate story unfolds, the American military and foreign policy is reorienting towards major power conflict with Russia. Now, George W. Bush, when he became president, he said, let's have better relations with Russia. He said, he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and could see that he could see his soul and he was a good man or whatever. When Barack Obama became president of the United States, Hillary Clinton went to Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, Putin's foreign minister, with a big red reset button and said, let's reset. Let's have better relations between Russia and the United States. And suddenly, it seems to me, at the very moment the Pentagon is reorienting its military strategy towards big power conflict with Russia, public opinion is being turned as if somebody wants to have decent relations with Putin, like that's a love affair with Putin. It doesn't have to be a love affair.
Well, so, I mean, when you describe the recent steps that have been taken to withdraw from the nuclear treaty and moving toward a much more dangerous positioning on risk of war and confrontation with Russia, isn't that John Bolton, though? I mean, isn't that sort of the role that he's been invited to come into play, I suppose?
Yeah, well, Trump brought him in
to be able to be the point person for moving the U.S. away from this lovey-dovey relationship that he has with Putin, while at the same time, I think, trying to distract us all from whatever role Russia may well have played to interfere with the 2016 election. I'm not convinced that didn't happen.
Well, okay, but I can hear you on this. Like, we don't have to be convinced about a negative. Like, did they do it or not do it? We're awaiting evidence. Like, if there's actual evidence and evidence is presented, because we know governments, all governments, and especially our own government, and maybe mainly our own government, has interfered in other countries' internal affairs and political elections. So I don't say it's impossible, but it seems to me that the Russian government would not have expected, because no one expected Donald Trump to actually become president of the United States, including Donald Trump. And what Mueller is actually saying about Russian interference, that this internet troll farm in St. Petersburg bought $100,000 worth of ads, 56% of which came after the election, none of which supported any particular candidate. Like, that would have been enough to tip the balance. It just doesn't ring true to me. But again, if we saw evidence from the Mueller probe, and that's what we're all waiting for, I mean, I think the Mueller probe should release all the documents. All that information should come out. It should be like people should be able to evaluate it, because it's dominated our political discourse for the past 2 years.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for keeping everything close to the vest until he's ready to actually reach a conclusion, because otherwise, you know, partial disclosure ends up being distorted and manipulated and creates a disjointed, possibly less credible result. And at this point, I'm just speculating on these questions. I do want to go back for a minute, though, about the assault on civil rights that Jeffrey Sessions was single-handedly or, you know, very much involved in, both prior to and during his tenure as the Attorney General. But what I see, I see this country, I see us taking, going one step further than simply setting back the clock. I see an actual aggressive use of what progress we have made over the last 40 or 50 years in the civil rights arena, and not only eliminating those rights, but actually turning them around to be used as a weapon against the historic victims of racism and sexism and gender discrimination and corporate abuse in this country. Because now the way in which the Department of Justice is interpreting the civil rights laws is to say that it's a violation of corporations' civil rights to put any constraints on the way that they act. It's a violation of homophobic people's civil rights to say you're not allowed to discriminate. It's a violation of white people's civil rights to say that, you know, you can't go around engaging in racially hatred and venomous speech. It's a violation of the First Amendment to prevent or put any constraints on our college campuses to, you know, try to put some sort of control over the rise of fascism in our country. And so that's what really kind of scares me more than anything, is the just sort of, you mentioned Alice in Wonderland, it's totally surreal.
Yes, I hear you on that. And I agree with you. I think I 100% agree with the point that you're making here, Julie Hurwitz. Julie is an attorney, a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm Goodman, Hurwitz & James. She's talking to us from Detroit, Michigan. Julie Hurwitz was one of the lawyers in the class action, filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of the Flint residents in Flint, Michigan, who were, you know, who had clean water and then it was taken away and they were given poisoned water because of greed, avarice, mismanagement, just bad decisions and blatant dishonesty. Julie Hurwitz is a longtime fighter for civil rights and social rights and economic rights. Julie, it is exactly as you put it. The victims of oppression in America historically, the victims of discrimination are now being presented as the great perpetrators of discrimination and oppression by virtue of trying to affirm their rights or to remedy historic wrongs so that people who were kept out of college or kept out of jobs or kept out of housing in particular neighborhoods, to the extent that any kind of affirmative action legislation and laws have been adopted and been used to try to remedy these wrongs, that's now presented as a form of racism against those who in the past have benefited from a bias. They have maybe haven't all benefited personally, but as a social grouping, certainly. You are right. That's what's going on. And Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump and the Trump administration have done that. They're promoting that. That's why I find it so troubling right now. And again, it kind of goes back to the big picture. If we're going to be an anti-Trump resistance movement, if the Democrats, if the Democratic Party is going to say to the people of this country, or certain liberals are going to say to the people of this country, Donald Trump's firing of this retrograde, racist, sexist, anti-gay bigot, Jeff Sessions, is a fundamental threat to democracy, then what happens is that the left and the progressive forces end up not only being the tail to sort of a moderate centrist politics, but in fact to a real reactionary politics, because Jeff Sessions and, as you pointed out, James Comey and Mueller, these guys, they have been targeting civil rights for a long time. Why would people line up behind them now? I think that's just the biggest possible political mistake.
You know, it's kind of like we're between a rock and a hard place in some respects. We are faced with a situation in this country right now where the president and his administration are literally doing everything in their power to dismantle the Constitution. You know, when Donald Trump announced a week or so ago that he had the power to take away birthright, which is written into the 14th Amendment, I'm telling you, and when he got away with that Kavanaugh appointment last month, and, you know, the combination of forces right now that are so set up to literally dismantle our constitutional democracy. And when I say democracy, I don't mean that we are a purely democratic country, because obviously we're not, but at least we had a constitution that was or has been until now able to be relied upon to allow us to move toward what would be a truly, you know, egalitarian democratic system.
But Jeff Sessions, though, was supporting Kavanaugh. I mean, that's the whole thing. He's been part of this whole cabal.
Absolutely. I mean, Jeffrey Sessions is no friend of anyone. That's the least bit human, in my opinion. And I don't really care whether he's fired or not. I do think, though, that I would like to see the Mueller investigation be brought to its conclusion.
Yes, I think the Mueller investigation should be brought to a conclusion.
An unfettered conclusion. I think that it should be allowed to run its course.
And I also think that the most important thing would be for the American people to actually have a chance to read all of the material, because I believe that when we go through and look at all of the material, we're going to find out that while the genesis of the Russiagate thing may have been the Democratic Party's sort of inability to explain its inexplicable defeat to such an odious figure and such an unpopular figure as Donald J. Trump, if it had its genesis there, it's morphed into something else. It's bigger than that now. And we need to know from the special counsel, what is there? What evidence actually is there of this Russian government manipulation such that we have Donald Trump as a president and as a consequence of that, as opposed to other things like the failure of the Democratic Party, its inability to speak directly to certain parts of the country, the domination of, say, of white supremacy in certain parts of the country, things that really don't have their genesis or their origin in the Kremlin. They're very, very homegrown. Anyway, that's my point.
Well, let's not forget the Democratic machine, absolute the evisceration of the Bernie Sanders campaign prior to the Democratic National Convention, when he well could have been the properly nominated candidate and would likely have won.
I think personally, and Julie was, you were a delegate in that process, I think Bernie Sanders would have undoubtedly at that time won. He would have taken all the supporters that Hillary Clinton had, plus he would have made inroads into industrial working class areas that Hillary Clinton seemed to be just immune from hearing people. Anyway, that's a bigger, longer discussion.
But yeah, that's right. I mean, it's no one thing, but I think that you can't discount the way in which the Trump campaign took full advantage of whatever it could to use Russia in any way that would have served its purpose. And I would like to see Mueller be able to complete his investigation and learn what he has to say about it.
Yeah, we need to find out if there's a there, and the only way that can happen is for all the information eventually, one way or the other, and I hope soon to come out and to be shared with the public. We're out of time. We were joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's an attorney. She is a civil rights lawyer and partner at the law firm Goodman, Hurwitz & James. We were joined earlier from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of a new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series. We do it every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com. He is also the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul, Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on the show, Brian.
Today, we want to focus on a number of the referendum and other criminal justice issues that came up in the in the elections that took place on Tuesday. We have some other stories as well that we'd like to get to. But Paul Wright, you're in Florida. We've talked in the past about Amendment 4. Again, Amendment 4 allows convicted felons to be re-enfranchised, to be able to vote, with the exception of those convicted of murder or sexual offenses. This passed. Whatever else happened, Paul Wright, in Florida, this was a big development. I know that you were disappointed with the referendum because it didn't cover all prisoners. But in terms of the big picture, what's your view?
Well, I think it's important that, you know, that everyone be able to vote, regardless of what they've been convicted of. And I'm also one of the people that believes that prisoners should be able to vote as well. So I guess it depends on what this means, and it's far from clear, because I think if this were viewed as, if this is just the first step towards re-enfranchising everyone that's been disenfranchised because of a felony conviction, I'd say then that's a positive development. If, as myself and others fear, this is the end of the road and this is it, the people that got on this boat and got enfranchised are it, and then the 80,000 sex offenders and murderers in Florida are not enfranchised and never will be, or won't be for, you know, a long, long time, then I think that's a different situation. So, but, you know, but I think that's also one of the differences too, though, of seeing as this passed, you know, fairly readily. There was no organized opposition to it. There's no, more importantly, there was no funded opposition to it. You know, I kind of wonder, maybe if murderers and sex offenders had been included in it, that would have passed too, and we would have even more democracy and more second chances and more redemption than this divide and conquer type amendment that did pass.
Kevin Gostalig, same question to you about Florida. It's big news. I think Paul Wright is right that there probably will not be, a political calculation made by anyone in Florida politics that there will be another referendum so that murderers and people convicted of sex offenses will now also have their rights. This was probably pretty much it, short of radical, profound social justice change, not just in Florida, but throughout the country. Nonetheless, Florida has gone out of its way to use felony convictions as a way to disenfranchise significant parts of the population. Certainly for those who now have the franchise, that will be considered a significant sort of reestablishment of their civil rights. But it does speak to the larger issue. If you've been arrested, you've gone through a trial, or if you've pled guilty, which is what most people do because they fear they don't have the resources to win a trial, you go to prison or you serve your time, why shouldn't everyone have the right to vote?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a significant question here of what is, and it's for Floridians in this case, what do the people of Florida think their criminal justice system should do? I mean, we talk a lot on this show about how the prison system, mass incarceration, is set up for retribution. As you know, Paul repeats over and over again, it's used as a way of controlling poor and other marginalized masses within the country. You know, as we talk about what the system actually does. But for Floridians, what do you want your system to do? Because if you believe that it is for rehabilitation, that people go to prison and then when they leave, they're able to reintegrate into society, then by designating classes of people by offenses so that they don't get to vote, you know, by discriminating against them, you're making it much harder for them to reintegrate after prison. And I would ask the liberal groups that supported this measure, if they have any thoughts or concerns about if this is how attempts to enfranchise or end disenfranchisement in other states will go. Do you know, are we going to see this in other places as this picks up? Because certainly you have seen a cultural shift away from believing that felons should remain disenfranchised after they get out of prison. And so then now are we talking about these different classes of offenses to entrench discrimination more widely across the country?
That's Kevin Gostalig. We're talking to Kevin and Paul Wright, as we do every Thursday in this segment on Loud and Clear called Criminal Injustice, where we take a look at the awful character of the U.S. criminal justice system, or what we might call, and what Paul Wright and Kevin Costello call, America's police state. Paul Wright, going back to you, you're in Florida. Black people have been disproportionately arrested and incarcerated in Florida. The new Amendment 4 passage will benefit black people the most, it would seem, in terms of aggregate numbers. In 2016, more than 418,000 black people out of a black voting age population of more than 2.3 million, that is 17.9% of potential black voters in Florida, had finished sentences but couldn't vote due to a felony record. That's according to the Sentencing Project. Now, Florida, like other southern states and non-southern states, have been subjected to the impact of federal intervention through the Voting Rights Act of 1965 because there was such a systematic, concerted, sort of comprehensive effort to deny black voters the right to vote or black potential voters the right to vote. And Florida has been right front and center in that effort to deprive black people of the right to vote. I'm just wondering why, under the circumstances of today with Amendment 4, was there not a big effort or any funded effort, as you pointed out, to stop this amendment or to have it go down to defeat? What's the thinking there?
Well, I think that the reality, though, is I think the people that were funding this, including the ACLU and the rich folks that backed it, I think that their thinking behind it is that it would, because it disenfranchised so many African American voters, that by re-enfranchising them, they would vote Democratic, and Florida would cease to be a swing state. That if you re-enfranchise enough African American voters, they'll vote Democratic. And that'll help the Democratic Party. But I think that the reality, though, is that despite the aggregate numbers, more white felons are impacted by Amendment 4, and more white felons will gain, in raw numbers, more white felons will get their voting rights back. And generally, white criminals are pretty conservative. They tend to vote Republican. And so I think that it could very well... So two factors are that generally felons tend to vote at very low rates, and I think that very rightly they see the two-party system offering very little to them. I'm one of those felon voters, and you know, one of my baseline things is who's opposed to the death penalty. That's, you know, a basic issue for me. And in our governmental system of the two-party candidates, generally I don't have anyone to vote for that shares my views on things. So, and I think that the same reason a lot of poor people don't vote in this country. They view the system as rigged. They view it as just basically a charade. They don't think that it offers them anything. So when you look at states where felons have been reenfranchised, they have very low voting rates. And there's been some studies that have been done about felons who are reenfranchised in Florida. Under the previous governor, around 155,000 felons were reenfranchised under Governor Charlie Crist. And they looked at their voting rates, which were low, and it came out that, you know, I think that nothing that's very surprising to people that work with criminal justice populations is that, you know, yes, the African-American felons tend to vote Democrat, and the white and Hispanic convicted felons tend to vote Republican. So, and that's been the pattern around the country. So I think that as far as the... Yeah, I think that as far as this having a net impact on future elections, I don't think it's going to have that big of an impact. And I think that the people who could have potentially funded it to oppose it, I think realize that is the fact that this is probably going to be a net advantage to the Republican Party.
Paul Wright, help us understand why this is more beneficial for white convicted felons rather than African Americans.
Well, just because in raw numbers, there's more of them. Despite the fact that African-Americans are disproportionately impacted in terms of actual raw numbers, there are more white felons who have been disenfranchised. So white felons are seeing their rights are going to see their rights restored at a higher rate. And the reality is that most white felons tend to vote Republican if they vote at all.
Kevin Gostala, let's go back to you. I'm looking at your website, shadowproof.com. People should check it out, not just for criminal justice issues, but many, many important issues. A wonderful website. You've done a sort of roundup of what happened in the elections on Tuesday regarding criminal justice issues. Let's talk, if we can, about Amendment A in Colorado.
Yeah, so this was a measure that was on the ballot. It actually had been on the ballot before in 2016. I'm not entirely certain if it had been put forward before, but I know that it was rejected in 2016. And so this time around, voters approved it, and it basically says that the state wants to remove the exception to the prohibition of slavery that's in the Constitution, which has been used nationwide to allow for the forced unpaid labor of prisoners in correctional facilities and detention centers across the country. And so this is a major development. Now, what's important about it is there's no actual reform tied, so there's nothing that kicks in right away as a result of the passage. It just maybe empowers prisoners to bring lawsuits to challenge the constitutionality of what's going on within facilities. That's how I understand it. But we've already talked about on this show this year how people are pushing, prisoners are pushing for wages to be paid to them, to be paid the minimum wage. We've seen in Colorado that this is something that they've pushed for. And so certainly with this outcome, it empowers them to continue their campaign to be paid for their work in prison.
Paul Wright, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important step towards challenging the legal status of prisoners as slaves. Most famously, the 13th Amendment allows for the enslavement of people who've been convicted of a crime, the famous exception to the ban on slavery. And unfortunately, a lot of state constitutions follow this language and allow for the enslavement of people that have been convicted of crimes. And so this is the first time I'm aware of the state has amended its constitution to eliminate the ban on prison slavery. So I think this is, you know, this is kind of like a huge first step that we're taking, I think, as far as challenging the notion that slavery in 2018 should not be acceptable for anyone, including prisoners in this country.
Quite something. How did it get on the ballot? Why did it win, Kevin?
Well, so there's been an effort, an organizing effort by a group called Abolish Slavery Colorado, or Abolish Slavery in Colorado. In fact, one of the organizers found in the days in the run-up to the election that someone took a literature from the campaign and set it on fire and left it in front of his house. This is an African-American man who was organizing in Colorado, one of the proponents who had been interviewed by news media and out there campaigning for people to support it. But you know, this actually won pretty handily. It wasn't very close as far as like whether people were going to reject it or not, or approve it or not. And so it definitely demonstrates, I mean, I think Colorado, especially when you look at the political makeup of the state, shows just how possible it is for strong criminal justice reforms to be pushed in this country.
Again, there's no enabling demand or legislation for how it impacts what actually happens to prisoners in the state of Colorado, as I understand it, Kevin. But can both of you or either of you see how this may have a practical impact going forward and point out some of the specific ways that it might?
Well, I think that the big thing, though, is that when prisoners have gone to court seeking the minimum wage or things like that, they always get smacked down by the language of the 13th Amendment. And I think the Virginia Supreme Court summed it up in an 1870 case, Ruffin versus Commonwealth, where they said prisoners are slaves of the state. And I think that by eliminating the language in the state constitution that allows prisoners to be enslaved, what they're doing is basically the federal constitution becomes the floor and the state constitution effectively is raising the ceiling on these claims. So that even if it's okay to enslave people under the federal constitution, at least in Colorado now, prisoners cannot be enslaved under the state constitution. So in theory, or I think as the thinking goes, prisoners that are enslaved in Colorado will now be able to go to state court and seek relief. And that includes being entitled to fair wages, you know, to be paid for their labor and things like that. So rather than being, you know, summarily dismissed, as has happened historically, they now have a means and a mechanism to basically challenge their slave status, at least in the state court system.
Yeah, that's important. Kevin, I think most Americans when asked whether slavery is still legal in the United States, would say no. Perhaps this also has a major educational impact in terms of consciousness, because people don't realize that the 13th Amendment, which was adopted to end the enslavement of African people as chattel slaves in the South and in big parts of the Mid-Atlantic and even northern areas, actually didn't end slavery. It sort of redefined slavery and who could be enslaved. I think most people don't know that.
I've seen a kind of glib reaction among liberal publications. I'll single out Mother Jones, which had a headline of like, it's 2018 and slavery's on the ballot. I think that cheapens what's been going on here, because it is a moment where we need to let people know seriously that there is a systematic legacy of slavery that has not been removed, has not been erased from this country. It continues to have huge ramifications, especially for people who are in prisons. We also saw on Tuesday in Louisiana that finally they got rid of their non-unanimous jury verdict scheme, which had been declared unconstitutional by a district court in October. And you know, if we're talking about slavery in the Constitution still and its impact on Black people here in this state, it was possible for defendants to see minorities stripped of their ability to influence the outcome of verdicts. It was possible for people to be convicted without a unanimous jury verdict, and it had a huge impact on Black defendants. And so, again, like, I think what you're saying is important. A lot of Americans may not fully realize how much of the legacy of slavery is still part of our mass incarceration system.
Paul Wright, same question. Louisiana voters, as Kevin mentioned, this was important. They overwhelmingly backed the measure to end the state's non-unanimous jury verdict scheme. Again, how did that get on the ballot? Why did it have this kind of important victory?
Basically, it just comes down to the people that are funding it. You've got foundations that are putting some money into funding some of this stuff. So the reason this injustice stuff has languished for decades and centuries and oppressed so many people is because no one with money was opposed to it. As long as just poor people of all colors and races being oppressed by it and screwed over, everyone was fine with it. And the political establishment, I think that's a critical thing to note, is that this stuff is being, to the extent that progress is taking place, it's because of the voters. It's not because of elected officials or legislatures or governors that are doing it. It's because of the voters. And the only reason this stuff is getting in front of the voters is because, you know, members of the American oligarchy are putting some money into this stuff and seeking change. So, and where they're putting the money into it, they are being successful and they are getting change.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright and Kevin Gostala, as we do every Thursday, about the big issues regarding the criminal injustice system, the system of mass incarceration, or what might be called America's police state. Okay, so good news, or limited good news in Florida, good news in Louisiana, good news in Colorado. Not such good news, Kevin Gostala, in Ohio. Talk about what happened there on Tuesday.
Yeah, and since we're probably pressed for time, I'll kind of lump this in with what happened in North Dakota. So in Ohio, they had an opportunity, if you were a voter, to lower drug possession and use offenses, make those misdemeanors. The state was telling voters through this initiative that, you know, you might have an opportunity to privilege or prioritize more addiction treatment. It was a possible thing that we could move away from just having retribution for drug offenses. Maybe there could be more rehabilitation in the state. But that was by 64% of voters, they decided not to support this measure. So I think that's really disheartening if you're a criminal justice reform advocate or you see what's going on is unjust. And then also I would lump this in with what happened in North Dakota, because again, out there, there was a chance to legalize marijuana, but as part of it, there was going to be an expungement of marijuana offenses. So I think it's important to, when we talk about these measures to legalize drugs, that in some of these states, we're actually seeing coupled with it the ability to expunge records and make it so that, you know, not only is it legal now, but you can go back and try to do something for some of the people who have been unjustly impacted by the war on drugs. But again, like in Ohio, they, for whatever reason, just didn't want this measure.
Paul Wright, back to you. And also explain the significance of expungement for our audience, again, for people who may not be familiar with the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so basically expungement is people that have been convicted of a certain crime, of crimes or whatever, illegal acts, is that often this comes up on employment histories, on applications for government benefits, you know, you name it. When you're asked, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And you have to answer yes. And so with this, so what drug legalization activists have tried to do in a lot of places is not just legalize marijuana, but also expunge convictions for prior criminal convictions related to that conduct. So I think the thinking goes, if marijuana is legal now, why should someone suffer the legal consequences of an arrest for marijuana, say 20 years ago, when it wasn't? And so that's why often the proponents of marijuana legalization are often try to lump the two in together on these ballot initiatives and things like that, which myself, I think that makes sense, but, you know, in some cases, maybe it muddies the waters. But because I think it follows that if you think the behavior should be legal now, why are you still penalizing people who were convicted of something that may have happened years or decades earlier when it wasn't? So it's kind of, I think, the keeping up with changing norms of society type thing.
Yeah, Kevin, back to you on the same question. The Michigan vote, which was important in terms of legalizing marijuana, still a lot of people in Michigan, no doubt, in prison right now, serving, in some cases, many cases, long sentences because they had pot or because they were involved in some way with marijuana. Any relief for them? How does that happen? What happens next?
Yeah, I think there's a lot up in the air, and I'm not sure what can be done. I'm not familiar with any part of this initiative that actually included expungement, so that's going to be a separate battle, as far as I know, for them to get some kind of justice. And I think as we see the spread of marijuana legalization, it's important to just bring in the very quickly the capitalist aspect of all of this. Because you've seen north of us in Canada through the legalization that all of these companies are mobilizing to make money off of legalized marijuana. But that doesn't mean the black market is going to go away, because it could be very expensive to get marijuana. So people will still grow their own. They'll get around restrictions in the regulations because they don't like how the government is regulating. And they're still going to open themselves up to offenses that could land them in prison. And this is in Canada. So here in the U.S., you can definitely expect the same sort of trajectory to follow. And I think it would probably be worse, knowing what we know about the U.S. so far and its war on drugs. And so that as we move forward and see more legalized marijuana in states, and then eventually it falls away federally, you'll have companies come in to make money. And because they want to protect their profits, we'll see people criminalized.
That's Kevin Gastala. We're also talking to Paul Wright. We do this every Thursday on this segment in Loud and Clear. We talk about the criminal injustice system. I want, in our last 4 minutes, to go to two other stories. Paul Wright, we can't not go back to the issue of mental health and the fact that America's prisons are nothing more than a cruel, barbaric warehouse for hundreds of thousands of people who need medical treatment, but instead are just locked up and thus become slaves of the state, as we've been talking about. I'm looking at a headline that one of you shared: inmate rips out her own eye and eats it, report slams mental health care in California prisons. God, what a story.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is all too common in prison legal news over the years. We've reported a number of instances where seriously mentally ill people commit these horrific acts of self-mutilation. And I think it just goes to illustrate, I think, how seriously mentally ill many of the people are in our prison system, the fact that they don't get treatment for the existing mental illness, and the way they are treated, often being put in solitary confinement, which we know exacerbates and worsens a mental illness. You know, it just ranges from, you know, bad to horrific. Unfortunately, I'd say at least once a year, every other year, we report these instances of horrific self-mutilation in different parts of the country. And I think it's worth noting, this is just the stuff that is becomes public knowledge. You know, who knows how much of this stuff is happening that doesn't make the newspapers. The only reason that this instance out of California, where the prisoner was only identified as inmate patient X, and this happened at the California Institution for Women in Chino in 2017, but the only reason that we know about this is because of a report by Dr. Michael Golding, the chief psychiatrist of the prison system, wrote a report about the serious failings and problems with the mental health care system in California, which has been under federal receivership and the subject of litigation for literally decades. And this is being used as an example of the shortcomings of this prison system's mental health care. And so now that it becomes public, and again, who knows how many more of these instances are happening as part of the same litigation. Recently, around 2 years ago, there's videotape released showing mentally ill prisoners being routinely pepper sprayed, shot with riot batons through the doors of their cells when they're basically having psychiatric collapses and psychiatric episodes. And yeah, this has just been kind of like a long, it's just been a long sorted history of not just benign neglect, but actually active abuse.
Let's bring in Kevin Gastella. Kevin, we have 30 seconds left. I mean, this is a real horror story, a real horror story. Just take us out.
Well, the most important point is that this is what happens when you have judges trying to exact oversight over the injustice that is rampant in this case, with mental health care treatment in prisons. And, you know, I think that's really striking to someone who's trying to see criminal justice reforms advance, because it tells you that even once you achieve the reforms, you don't even know that they're going to actually be implemented.
All right. That was the voice of Kevin Gastella. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com, co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. We were also joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You can hear this segment every Thursday on Criminal Injustice at 4:30 p.m. at SputnikNews.com Live. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio. You can hear it at Spotify, Spreaker. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.